this is the second time I've come to speak on a similar topic, but that was 10 years ago, so, or something like that, eight to 10 years ago. So any of you who were at that first time is unlikely, and I'm sure you will have forgotten what it was I had to say then. So, this work that I'm going to talk to you about, it's, I'm really revisiting this material. I've had some new ideas since I originally started working on this stuff. And it was work of Fratini Markopoulou, who I met some years ago, that stimulated, if that's the word, me to try to take what she had done using tapas theory, which I have worked for a number of years, and applying it to space-time theory and to quantum theory, and in particular to the idea of set or objects evolving in space-time over a causal set. And it struck me then that one can reformulate and extend the framework that she had been using, I think, rather in a sort of illuminating way, by casting it in the form of former set theory, what I call frame-valued set theory, which is an extension of the idea of a Boolean valued model of set theory that's customarily used to establish independence proofs in set theory. And again, an area that I've worked in for on and off for a number of years. this sort of work can be presented, I think, in quite an illuminating way, and I hope to convince you of that. Okay, so in space-time physics, any set of events, let's say C, is called a causal set, is taken to be partially ordered by the relation, well, I've written as equal to or less than here, of possible causation, okay? So for any events P and Q, P is equal to or less than Q means that Q is in P's future light cone. Some time ago, Fratini Markopoulou proposed that the causal structure of space-time itself be represented by sets evolving over C. That is, in essence, it's a certain structure, certain categories that tapas set to the C of pre-sheaves on the opposite category, or the pre-ordering going, the ordering going the other way, C-op. Now, here I'm going to show how the tapas theoretic framework she employed may be effectively replaced by a certain model of intuitionistic set theory with, I hope, illuminating results. Now, to facilitate the exposition, I mean, it may seem a bit perverse to do this right away, but it'll turn out there's a reason for this, sort of technical reason for this. I'm going to reverse the causal ordering. So, in other words, we're going to replace the original causal set with its opposite, that is, with the ordering going the other way. And we'll simply call this thing P, right? So P will be a set of events, and it'll be pre-ordered. We're not going to assume that the ordering is anti-symmetric. A pre-ordering, as you probably know, has all the conditions of the ordering or partial ordering, except that it's not anti-symmetric, so it's reflexive and transitive. And it turns out that the reason, again, for doing this, although it does have a kind of physical meaning, as we'll see, is that in category theory, pre-ordered sets are rather natural as categories, and partially ordered sets are actually quotients of them, and they're not so convenient to work with. However, P will then be a set of events, as we'll call them, pre-ordered by the relation equal to or less than, which is now the, right, we're going to stick with that sign. And where now Q is equal to or less than P is intended to mean that Q is in P's future light cone, or that P could be the cause of Q, or equally, that Q could be an effect of P. Notice that since this is reflexive, each event will conventionally be regarded as being in its own future light cone. I mean, it's just a convention. So in other words, we don't remove P from the sort of apex of the cone. We include it there. Accordingly, for each event P, the set, which is going to figure a lot here, P would P downward, which is the set of elements below P, may be identified as the causal future of P, or the set of potential effects at P. It's really the events in the future light cone of P, and it's going to figure its physical meaning is clear. It's also, of course, a very important mathematical construction. Now, in requiring that the equal to or less than be no more than a pre-ordering, that is, in dropping the anti-symmetry of equal to or less than. As I say, this is convenient from a mathematical standpoint, but in physical terms, we're allowing for the possibility that the universe is of Gödelian type, right? It might have closed time light lines in which a future event, so to speak, could also be a cause of a previous one. That's not going to play any particular role here, but nevertheless, it's worth noting. So accordingly, we fix a pre-ordered set P pre-ordering equal to or less than, which we'll call the universal causal set. This is the term that Marco Polo used. Marco Polo, in essence, suggested that viewing the universe from the inside, a phrase that she used in her original paper, amounts to placing oneself within the topos of pre-sheaves set to the p-op. We don't need to know about pre-sheaves here, but that's that was the categorical framework she originally used. And the idea here, I mean, I'll just mention it briefly. The objects in a category of set-valued pre-sheaves, right, it doesn't necessarily have to be over a partially ordered set or a pre-ordered set. It could be over a general category. I mean, the p-op could be a term. The idea is that these sets are in some way varying over the objects of the category. This was a view. This is where you get the idea of variable sets, which is an idea that Bill O'Veer had been put forward long ago, decades ago, and it's really quite suggestive. So here, her idea was, well, we think of objects varying over events, that is, depending on the position in space-time, the event occurs, the object will have a certain identity, which can then change as events continue to take place. Now, we're going to suppose, this is just a kind of informal introduction, we're going to suppose that we're given a certain relation. Well, the term for this is forcing. It comes originally from independence proofs in set theory. It was a sign that Paul Cohen used years ago when he proved the independence of the continuum hypothesis. It's had many uses since, in particular here. Between events P and mathematical sentences sigma, the term mathematical sentence will make more precise later. It'll be a sentence in the language of set theory. With additional parameters, you take a statement, a physical statement, and translate it in the appropriate way in mathematical form, and then retranslate that into set theoretical terms, assuming you could do that. That's the idea behind the term mathematical sentence. We'll think of P forcing sigma as asserting that given the occurrence of any event in the future light cone of P, the sentence sigma then becomes true or holds in the space-time associated with P. That's fundamentally the idea. So sort of briefly, the forcing relation there is that once the event occurs, it causes in some way the truth of a sentence defined over the whole space-time. We'll see this more clearly in the models that I introduce later. It's then clear that, and this is an important fact, that the relation is persistent in the sense that if P forces sigma and then you have a future event in a future light cone of P, then Q also forces sigma. Persistence is a very important property generally of forcing relations, and it will hold here given that informal idea of forcing. Okay, for each sentence sigma then, the set, well, I don't know how to read that, the value of sigma, it's a double. Here it's a double bracket, customarily used for assigning truth values. which is the set of P, for each set, the set of events which force it to be true, measures the degree or extent to which sigma holds. The larger this is, the truer this is. In particular, when the value is the whole of P, sigma is universally or absolutely true. All right, it's true from the get-go, so to speak. It's always true. And when it's empty, sigma is universally or absolutely false. It never becomes true. These values of sigma, sentences sigma, may accordingly be thought of as truth values, with P corresponding to absolute truth and the empty set to absolute falsity. Of course, in the classical case, you only have these two situations, right, where the thing is either one, the whole thing that corresponds to truth value, one, and zero. But in general, since we're working with larger partially ordered sets than just having one element, right, which would be the case there, we're going to have many intermediate values.
Is sigma to be thought of as a function with one argument?
No, it's a sentence. It's going to be a sentence of set theory, as we'll see. Just think of it as a mathematical sentence of some kind. No. It's a relation between P and sigma. It doesn't have P in it.
No. Okay. Sigma. When you say you have to have a sentence, sigma.
Yes.
Does that have, a place where you stick P?
It might have P in it, but it might not. It might be the sentence that says the continuum hypothesis is true. You'll see. The informal introduction is already causing puzzlement, but anyway. Yeah, okay, we'll get down to the specific. You'll see how it comes. P could figure in it, yes, as we'll see, and it does in a number of cases, but it doesn't necessarily have to have P in it. Okay. All right. Now, because of the persistence property, each value of sigma has the property of being closed under potential effects, or, if you like, causally closed. That is, it satisfies, if P is in sigma and Q is equal to or less than P, then Q is in the value of sigma. Now, this is a very familiar type of condition, and it has a name, or the objects, subsets of a partially ordered set, or more generally in categories. It has a name, they're called sieves. Sieves serve as generalized truth values measuring the degree to which assertions hold. The term sieve is, as I say, a general term that's used in category theory. This is a special case where you're looking at a particularly simple kind of category, which is a preordered set, where you only have this one relation there. The set P hat, if you like, or P curve, it's actually a little curve over, let's call it P hat, of all sieves, or truth values, has a natural logical algebraic structure, which is, again, very standard, that of what's called a complete Heiting algebra, or briefly, a frame. This concept is defined in the following way, and let me give a definition. A lattice is a partially ordered set. Probably you're familiar with these definitions, but with a partial ordering in which each two-valued subset has a supreme or join denoted by X, so it sort of looks like this. There's X, and there's Y, and there's a least thing above it, which is the join, and there's the greatest thing below it, which is called the mean, like this. So that's, this diagram here indicates why the term lattice was introduced. I can't remember who, Peirce, possibly, long ago. Okay, a lattice is complete if every subset, including the empty set, has a supremum or join, that is a greatest least upper bound, denoted by the generalized join there, join of X, and an infimum or meet, a greatest lower bound, denoted by the dual form, this thing here. The join of the empty set will then be the least or bottom element, which is denoted by zero, and the meet of the empty set will be one, the largest. Or equally, you could take the join of the whole of L, if you like. It would amount to the same thing. Now, Heiting algebra, which is what we're going to be concerned with mainly here, is a lattice with top and bottom elements such that for any elements x and y, there's an element denoted by x arrow y of L, which corresponds to implication. I mean, if meet and it corresponds to conjunction and joined to disjunction, that this is going to correspond to implication, which satisfies this condition that for any z, z is equal to or less than x arrow y, if and only if the meet of x and z is equal to or less than y. So x arrow y is the largest element such that z meet x is equal to or less than y. So if we write not x, this is how negation is introduced, for x arrow 0, then this not x is the largest element z such that x arrow z that's a typo. It should be x meet z is equal to 0. It's called the pseudo-complement of x. Now, Boolean algebra, that I'm sure everybody should be familiar with here, is a special case of all this. It's a hiding algebra in which that satisfies the law of double negation, right, in which not x is equal to x for all x, or equivalently if the corresponding counterpart of the law of excluded middle holds, that x join not x is 1 for all x. Now, if we think of the elements of a complete Boolean algebra as truth values, then 0, 1, with all these operations here, represent true, false, and or not, it implies, there exists, and for all, respectively. Those are how logic gets interpreted in hiding algebras. The laws satisfied by these operations in a general hiding algebra correspond to those of intuitionistic logic. In Boolean algebras, the counterpart of the law of excluded middle also holds. So that really gives you classical logic, and that's the algebraic way, excuse me, the algebras associated with intuitionistic logic are hiding algebras, and those with classical logic are Boolean algebras. Now, a basic fact about complete hiding algebras is that the following identity holds, a form of the distributive law. The dual form, by the way, doesn't hold in general, although it does in Boolean algebras, that the meet distributes over join over arbitrary join. Conversely, in any complete lattice satisfying that condition, defining the operation by arrow by this will turn it into a hiding algebra. So complete hiding algebras are really complete lattices that satisfy this condition, this distributive law. I should also just mention briefly that it corresponds to a law of logic in intuitionistic logic, that conjunction distributes over, that existential quantification distributes over conjunction where one of the formulas doesn't have the quantified variable in it. So in view of this result, a complete hiding algebra is frequently defined to be a complete lattice satisfying that condition. As I've said, a complete hiding algebra is briefly called a frame. Okay. Now let's look at this frame that we had here, the one starting from P. It turns out that the equal to or less than is inclusion. Remember, each member of this is a P hat, is a sieve, so it's a subset of P. Certain kind of subset of P. And the relation here is inclusion. Joins and meets are just set theoretic unions and intersections, and the operations, we're not really be using this here, but I just mentioned how these are defined. For two sieves, I arrow J is defined to be the set of elements P, which is such that the intersection of I with the right with the sieve generated by P is included in J, and a similar thing for the negation. Okay, see if I can keep my act together here. Where is 5? There it is. Okay, frames do duty then as the truth value algebras of the current, let's say, the current language of mathematics, which despite all the efforts to defirm it, by category theorists, including me, is still the sort of standard language, set theory. To be precise, associated with each frame H is a structure which we'll call is VH. V is usually a symbol used usually just for the universe of sets, the class of all sets, if you like. And VH is the H-valued version of it. You can think of V as being the usual two-valued Boolean version where sentences are either true or false in an absolute sense. And VH is an extension of that to sets that where membership is actually not just given two truth values. It's actually, it can be any truth value in H. It's called the universe of H-valued sets, and it has the following features. The most familiar form of this is where H is a Boolean algebra, and Boolean valued set theory is very well known. But the extension to H is interesting and important in this case, and we'll see. So here are the key features of that. We're going to be working in this structure VH. So let's just have a few of the basic ideas, properties that we'll need. Each of the I should just say, VH is built up in a certain way. There are various ways of constructing it. I'm going to spare you the detail. But just think of the members of VH as being H-valued sets. So that the idea is that when you when you ask whether something is in it, in an H-valued set, so that A is a member, let's say, of some H-valued set X, then that gets a certain truth value, which is a member of H, which isn't necessarily 0 or 1. So each of the members of H actually, in this case, is a map from a subset of VH to H. So you can think of it, right, just as with characteristic functions. Sets can be usual two-valued sets, could be identified with their characteristic functions, as functions taking value 1 if something is a member of it and 0 outside. And that's an extension of that idea. Corresponding to each sentence sigma, the language of set theory, with names for all the elements of VH. So it's going to have, you allow names for everything that's actually in this universe. It's another element, again, called, which would be a member of H, called its truth value. And this is in H. These truth values will satisfy the following conditions. We don't really need all of them, but I'll just mention a few of them. To calculate this, I could really skip these. Of course, you have to define what you mean by the equality. These are the atomic sentences. It's the usual pattern. You start out by assigning truth values to atomic assertions, membership assertions, and equality assertions in a certain way. I'll spare the details here. This is done by a kind of recursion, but it's not going to be important for us. The logical operations, the values assigned to statements involved, sentences involving logical operations are given in the natural way. For example, the value of a conjunction is given as the meat of the values, disjunction similarly, negation and so forth similarly. For the quantifiers, there is an X will be the join over all possible members of the universe of the substitution instances, and the universal quantification will be the meat of all those. So that's the sense in which this corresponds to join, and the universal quantifier corresponds to meat. A sentence is valid or holds at VH, and we write it like this with a double turnstile here. If the value is 1. I mean, the value could have any value between 0 and 1. But if it's 1, we say that it holds universally, if you like, or is valid in VH. Now, an important fact that we're going to use implicitly, not to any real depth, but it's important. The axioms of intuitionistic Zermelo-Frankel set theory are valid in VH. You take the usual set theory, and you use intuitionistic logic. That's intuitionistic Zermelo-Frankel set theory. It really has the same axioms as the usual system, but you don't use classical logic. In this sense, VH is an H-valued model of intuitionistic ZF. Accordingly, the category set to the H of sets constructed within VH, if you take the usual set theory and then construct the category of sets, right, within that set theory, where the objects of the category are all the sets, and the arrows or mappings or morphisms are functions between the sets, you get what's called a topos, a special important sort of category that kind of generalizes, produces a kind of generalized set theory. But anyway, if you do the same thing here, you get a topos, and it can be shown to be equivalent to the topos. Well, we're not going to be using that here, but for those who know sheaf theory, it's actually equivalent to the topos of canonical sheaves on H, although that's not going to be of any importance here. Another important fact, there's a canonical embedding of the usual universe of sets into VH. So for each X, which is a standard set, there's a way of representing it within VH, and it's called X hat, and it will satisfy the following conditions, most of which we won't really need explicitly, but I'll just mention some of them. The only really important fact here is that if you take a sentence or a formula where all the quantifiers are restricted, that is, they're restricted to range over sets, not over the whole universe, then the truth of an assertion involving x1 to xn, say sets x1 to xn, is equivalent to the corresponding assertion in VH, where X1 to XN are replaced by their corresponding images in VH. Here? Ooh, oh, that's great. Oh, yes, somebody, I was promised a hockey stick. I now remember. Where's the puck? That's the question. Okay. That's very novel. Okay. All right, so it follows from the last, yes, one point that just to, maybe to keep our bearings. V2 is just the usual universe of sets. I mean, it's essentially the same. That is, if your Heiting algebra has just got two elements, so it's a two-element Boolean algebra, then essentially you just get the universe of sets back. So it follows from the last of these assertions that the canonical represent we can represent H itself, right, in H hat in VH, and it is a Heiting algebra in VH as well, and it actually follows from the last of those assertions I said there. A particularly important H set, that is a set of VH, is the following, is one defined by this. That its domain, remember, H-valued sets are really they're functions on the whole on parts of VH into H, just like characteristic functions. And the domain of phi H will be the set of all the images of the members of H, which of course is a subset of VH, because each of the A hats is. And I'm not even using it, am I? So. Okay. And its value is an A hat. It's just A. So it goes back to. Then you could show that this is a subset in the VH sense. It's a subset of H hat. And for any A in H, you have this when you work out, when you make the calculation. Particular for any sentence sigma, the value of sigma is the same as the value of the corresponding hat of the value in phi H. So in this sense, phi H represents the true sentences in VH. Phi H is called the canonical truth set in VH. It's actually a familiar construction from Boolean valued set theory. It's interesting that it plays a role in this. It will appear in this setup. So now let's get back to our causal set, P. Now the top is set to the P hat of sets in VH, in VP hat, which is the thing is equivalent to the topos of canonical sheaves on P hat, which we don't need to know about. It's well known that this is equivalent to the topos set to the P op of pre-sheaves on P, which was the original framework that Fatini Markopoulou used, right? And this is where she was working, in this thing here. I propose to work in here instead, and it produces some, I think, quite nice results. I better be careful with that. I don't want to trip up over it. Okay. So my proposal then is that we work in P hat rather than as did Markopoulou within set to the P op, the category of pre-sheaves. Accordingly, describing what the universe looks like from the inside, this is the term that she used, will amount to reporting the view from this thing, V, right, the universe of p-hat valued sets, rather than set to the category of pre-sheaves. The difference in the two descriptions is this. Within set to the p-op, objects clearly manifest individual variation because a pre-sheaf is a functor of a certain kind, but it's a function, so that you get different values of the object at different times or at different events. So you actually see the variations in terms of arrows directly. Within VP hat, on the other hand, objects are formally treated as static, and their variation is manifested through the fact that they're subject to the laws of intuitionistic logic. And to me, this is a very nice idea. I mean, you can, in other words, all of the variation is really carried by the logic. This is, of course, a lesson you learn when you do this sort of thing. Okay. Now, for simplicity, let's write H for this P hat here. So we're just H for Heiting algebra. It's a complete Heiting algebra. So H will always now stand for this P hat, the complete Heiting algebra of sieves, right, in H. The truth value of which we've already defined of a sentence sigma is a sieve of events in P, and it is natural to think of the events in sigma as those at which sigma holds. So one could introduce the forcing relation formally here in P, between sentences and elements of P, by saying that P forces sigma if and only if P is a member of the of the truth value, which is a sieve of sigma. This then you can show that this satisfies, they're called Kripke, the Kripke rules for forcing things as you sort of expect. Some of them are that phi and psi is forced to be true if and only if both the phi and psi are forced to be true. Conjunction is a disjunction is evaluated in the same way. Phi implied psi, on the other hand, involves a quantification over events in the future light cone. This is a typical of these are the very familiar rules. So for example, phi implies psi is forced to be true at P if and only if all future events Q. If phi is forced to be true by Q, then so is psi. Forcing a negation means that at no an event will force a negation if and only if no future event in the future light cone forces it to be true. And then for the conjunction and disjunction, it's what you sort of expect. Universal and existential quantification would go over into every, and then this goes over to some. So that's not really very surprising. Okay, well, now we define an important H-valued set. This set K by the domain of K, the domain of K will be the hats of the members of P. That's again a subset of VH, right? Because each of these things, the P hats is. And the value, the value assigned in H will be, very simply, it is just the sieve generated by P, which of course is a member of H. Then in VH, K is a subset of P hat, as you could easily show. And for P in P, you have the following. As you can show, I'm not proving all these things here. It would take too long, but they're not very difficult to prove what you just from the rules. The truth value of P hat in K is actually equal to P downward. Now, K is actually the counterpart in VP hat or VH of Marco Polo, what she called the evolving set past in her original paper. And it has a particularly simple representation here. And P hat itself is the VH counterpart of the constant pre-shape with value P, which she called world. She had these three past world and then the negation of K, which I'll come to in a moment. The fact that for any P and Q in P, we have the following. This is an important equation. I'll refer to this as equation star, or equivalent, sorry. Equivalent star. That Q forces P hat a member of K, if and only if Q is in the future light cone of P. And it may be construed as asserting that the events in the causal future of a given event are precisely those forcing the canonical representative of that event to be a member of K, right? In VH. Or equally, the events in the causal past of a given event are precisely those forced by that event to be a member of K. For this reason, we'll call K the causal past set in VH. It's a particularly important set. It played a central role in Marco Polo's formulation. It played a central role in her account, and it'll play a central role here too. Now, if we identify each P with what we're going to do, we want to make P a certain subset of H, and we do that by identifying P with its downward with the sieve generated by it. You can then regard P as a subset of H, so that in VH P hat is a subset of H hat, right? Because that just goes over. If A is a subset of B, then in VH A hat is a subset of B hat. It's not hard to show, and I won't. This is one of the usual. It isn't really very hard, but anyway. That actually K is the intersection of the original truth set that we introduced as phi H with P hat. You can also show that for any sentence sigma is actually equal to this, and just ignore that we don't really need to think about that. And by using moderate abuse of notation, in other words, hand waving, you can show that in VH, sigma holds if and only if there's a P in K, right, an event, if you like, in K, which forces it to be true. That is, and this is very suggestive, this is the point, this is why K plays an important role here, In VH, a sentence holds precisely when it is forced to do at some causal past stage in K. This establishes the centrality of K and correspondingly that of the evolving set past in Marco Polo's original account in determining the truth of sentences from the inside, that is, inside the universe VH. Now, Marco Polo also considered the complement of past. In the present setting, that's the VH set, not K, right? Thinking of K as a subset of H. Here we are. And that's defined. It's defined in this way. Let me find. It's defined in this way. P hat is in not K is the sentence that it's the same as this, that P hat not being in K. And then when you calculate that, it turns out that it's the negation of P, right, in the hiding algebra H. It's actually the negation of P downward. And that turns out, that turns out to be the setup there, the set of Q such that for all R equal to or less than Q, R is not equal to or less than P, and that's missing a right bracket there, but never mind. Marco Polo called that, well, mutatis mutandis wasn't exactly the same terminology, the events in not P downward, those beyond P's causal horizon, in that no observer at P can ever receive information from any event in not P downward. Since clearly, well, it's not hard to show that Q forces P hat in not K, if and only if Q is in the negation of the downward, of P downward. It follows, this is how you'd read that, the events beyond the causal horizon of an event P are precisely those forcing the canonical representative of P to be a member of not K, the negation of K, or the complement of K, I really should say. In this case, complement K reflects or measures the causal structure of P. Now, in this connection, it's natural to call not P hat, the double complement. And remember, you're working in intuitionistic logic here, and double complements actually don't coincide. They're usually proper subsets of the set you started with. They're not always the same. Sorry, it's the other way around. The set is a proper subset often of the double complement. And that will be this thing here for all the set of Q when you work it out. That for all R equal to or less than Q, there is an S equal to or less than R, such that S is equal to or less than P. Okay, that's a mouthful. But if you read it, we call it the causal horizon of P. It consists of those events Q for which an observer placed at P could, in its future, receive information from any event in the future of an observer placed at Q. Since, again, it's easy to see that Q forces P hat in not in the double complement of K, if and only if Q is in the double complement of the double negation, double complement of P downward. It follows, then, that the events within the causal horizon of an event are precisely those forcing the canonical representative of P to be a member of the double negation. So this establishes, really, the role that K, a complement K, a double complement K play in this formulation. Marco Polo had accounts of all of these using diagrams, but this is really, I think, a lot more straightforward, at least it appears so to me. Now, it's easily shown that not K is empty, that is, VH satisfied that not K is zero, is the empty set, if and only if P is directed downwards. Not very hard to show. That is, for any P and Q in P, there is R in P for which R is equal to or less than P and R is equal to or less than Q. So in other words, two P and Q always have, I mean, in other words, the future light cones always overlap. I mean, that's essentially what that's saying. This holds in the case considered by Marco Polo of discrete Newtonian time evolution. In the present setting, the case in which P is the opposite of the totally ordered set of natural numbers, so the ordering here will get reversed. Actually, it occurred to me later, or recently, I should say, that in fact, if you could extend this, you could use, for example, all the integers, right, positive and negative, and this would give you one without either an initial event or a final event, and the argument here would be the same as I'm going to give in the case of n. It might be more natural actually to consider that case than n, but anyway, the point is, okay. Now here are the corresponding. I think this is quite cute. This was not. something that it's not obvious at all in Marco Polo's setup, but it is here. Here, the corresponding complete hiding algebra H is the family of all downward closed sets of natural numbers in the, of course, in the opposite ordering. In this case, the H value, it has a really nice property. The H valued set K representing past is neither finite nor actually infinite in VH. For those of you who've done any philosophy, this is what Kant said, actually, about time, as we'll see. But anyway, it turns out that in this formal sense, anyway, I'm going to, there's a calculation that you make, which I won't run through completely. I just indicate roughly what you do. You first of all show it can't be finite. And you'll show, you show this essentially by showing that it's the double negation, that it's not the case that every natural number is in K. And you could easily show that if K is finite, then it certainly, that certainly can't hold. Right. So you show that, in other words, that it isn't finite, but it's not actually infinite, because if it were, you'd be able to inject the natural numbers into it. I mean, we're all sort of familiar with that idea. An actually infinite set, I mean, right, you'd be able to inject right, the natural numbers into it. well, if it were actually infinite in this sense, potentially infinite, I just mentioned this, potential infinity in this setting, classically there's no difference between actual infinity and potential infinity, but here you have a formal way of dealing with it, right? An actually infinite set is one that which you could inject the natural numbers into it. A potentially infinite one is one that just isn't finite, I mean, in the sense that it may grow indefinitely. And we're sort of familiar with that idea when we think, for example, about a future time in the usual way, if time goes on forever. Okay, well, if that's the case, then you can show, if it were actually infinite, then you would be able to show that for every member of K, there would be a bigger one, you know, just as in the natural numbers. And then you that would have to hold in VH. But when you make the calculation, using the rules, you calculate the truth value of that statement, you find it's zero. So it's false, and therefore K isn't actually infinite. So that's another nice feature. And in fact, it still works even if you take, instead of the natural numbers, you take omega plus omega, and the ordering of Z, right, of the integers. It'll work there too, the same reason. So in evolving Newtonian spacetime, the set K representing past time is potentially but not actually infinite. This is, in essence, what Kant asserted long ago. It isn't fair to classical set theory to say that you can't do this. You can have sets which are potentially infinite but not actually infinite, provided you don't have the axiom of choice. And it's well known that the axiom of choice implies that any potentially infinite set, in the sense I've described here, is not finite, has to be infinite, there'll be an injection. But if you don't have the axiom of choice, that isn't true. So there is a way of doing it, but here it comes out very... Oh, I should also say the axiom of choice, of course, doesn't hold. It's characteristic of these sorts of setup. The axiom of choice fails. Okay, but that's not going to be of any importance here. All right, so where's number 11? There we are. Okay, now in order to formulate an observable causal quantum theory, I haven't got much to say about this, but nevertheless, it's it would, I think, come out quite nicely if anybody did it. Marco Polo considered the possibility of introducing a causally evolving algebra of observables, which is natural enough. I mean, algebra observables, the C-star algebra, and you know, you can think of that as varying over the events. This amounts to specifying a pre-sheaf A of C star algebras on P, which in the present framework, which is rather nice, corresponds to specifying a single set A in VH, which formally satisfies the condition of being a C star algebra. So internally, it is just a C star algebra. It's viewed from VH, it's just a single thing, and just satisfying the condition of being a C star algebra in the sense of VH. The internal C-star algebra A is then subject to the intuitionistic internal logic of VH. Any theorem concerning C-star algebra is provided only that it be constructively proved. I mean, quite a lot of work has been done on this sort of thing, trying to prove these theorems constructively, because then they automatically hold, you see, in these more in these more general universes. Any theorem then automatically applies to A. Reasoning with A is much more direct and simpler than reasoning with the right, with the original pre-sheaf, at least it seems so to me. The same procedure of internalization can be performed with any causally evolving object, of course. Each such object of type T corresponds to a set S and VH satisfying in VH, S is of type T. Internalization may also be applied in the case of the pre-sheaves, anti-chains, and graphs considered by Marco Polo. So here for each event P, anti-change P consists of all sets of causally unrelated events in past P, while graphs P is a set of all graphs supported by elements of anti-chains P. In the present framework, anti-change is represented by what you'd expect, right? The set of subsets where X is an anti-chain and graph where G is a graph supported by A. So you can get quite nice formulations of those ideas internally. Again, the properties of this are handled very readily. You just have to use intuitionistic logic or argue constructively. It's an interesting sideline, though. There have been arguments about how many physical mathematical propositions that are typically used in physics can be proved constructively. There's been a fair argument going on about that. Maybe I'll mention that later. But anyway. Now, here's the part that I don't think that was really new, at least I think I can claim it was. I thought that the idea of in Topper's theory, it's very natural to go from pre-sheaves to sheaves, or starting with a Topper, you introduce something called a cover scheme or a Grothendieck topology, and then there's a certain construction that's performed that gives you a new Topper corresponding to this notion of cover. Here we only need to know that you look at some very simple cases of this, which are quite suggestive, I think, and interesting physically. So cover schemes or Grothendieck topologies may be used to force certain conditions to prevail in the associated models. That's what they're primarily used for. For those of you who may have heard of something called synthetic differential geometry, where you can, and it's going on, you can actually do general relativity, and it really was designed to do differential geometry using infinitesimals. You actually force a category to have the property that every function from real on objects is smooth. There are no discontinuous functions. And this is forced by using essentially Grothendieck topologies. It's an elaborate construction, but once you actually get the model, it's very easy to work with. So anyway, we're going to look at some very simple examples of this. It's called sheafification, but anyway, we wouldn't need that. A cover scheme on P is a map assigning to each P a family CP of subsets, right, of the sieve generated by P, that is, if you like, events in the future like cone, called C covers of P, such that if Q is equal to or less than P, any cover of P can be sharpened to a cover of Q in this sense. That if S is in CP and Q is equal to or less than P, then there's a cover of Q, which is such that every member of T is equal to or less than something in the original cover S. Let's explain that in words. It's really quite suggestive. A cover S of an event P may be thought of as a sampling, if you like, of the events in P's causal future, a survey of P's potential effects. In short, a survey of P. Using this language, the condition immediately above becomes, for any survey S of a given event P and any event Q, which is a potential effect of P, there is a survey of Q, each event in which has the potential effect of some event in S. Well, that's what I mean by that condition on surveys. Now, it happens that there are three naturally defined cover schemes. These are the simplest ones that you can get, really, on pre-ordered or partially ordered sets that we've considered. First, each sieve A and P determines two cover schemes, which I'll call CA, lower A, and upper A, defined by this. This is one condition. S is in CAP if and only if P is in A, the union of A and S, and it's in the upper one if P downward intersect A is included in S. Now, you don't need to worry so much about the exact way those are defined. It's really the important features that you can work out that they have, which are quite suggestive, I think. Okay. Now, if P is in A, any part of P causal future thus counts as a CA survey of P. And any part of P's causal future extending the common part of that future with A counts as a C upper A. Notice that then the empty set is in CA if and only if P is in A, and it's in the upper one if and only if it doesn't intersect with the that A doesn't intersect the future light cone of P. Here's another one, the dense cover scheme, which has got this condition. And I'll read that. I will just say it in words. S is a dense survey of P provided that for every potential effect Q of P, there's an event in S with a potential effect in common with Q. Now, given a cover scheme C and P, a sieve will set to encompass an element if I includes a C cover. The term covering is the idea that came from Grothendieck in algebraic geometry, that covers are like they're coverings. If you take a topological space, for example, then you take an open set, and the covering with other the cover, a particular kind of cover scheme, would be the collections of open sets whose union contains the given open set. That would be a special case of that's actually called the canonical covering system, and it comes from there's some axioms that Grothendieck introduced called axioms for Grothendieck topology, which essentially characterizes the idea of coverings in this way. But we don't need to know that. But that's where the idea comes from. It really does mean the idea is that the P is in something something's in CA of P if and only if in some sense A covers P, and you can sort of see that in the topological case very clearly, or the set theoretic case very clearly. Okay, so thus a sieve encompasses P if it contains all the events in some survey of P. That's what the way it would be described here. We'll call IC closed if it contains every element of P that it encompasses. And then, again, this is a technical, we're only going to be using some of the properties of this. The set of all C closed, if you do the same thing that you did with P here, you take the C closed sieves in P, partially ordered by inclusion, and you can show that's a frame. Right? There's an argument that shows that that's a frame. These are the frames obtained from the original frame by introducing coverings, by looking. It's the frame induced by the covering in which the operations of meet and join coincide with those of P. We don't need to worry about how the other operations are defined. Passing from the original thing, VP, right, that we had originally, VP hat, to VC hat is actually what's called the process of, it's called sheafification, right, in category theory or in algebraic geometry. But anyway, we won't be using that. But the idea is now we move from VP hat to this new universe, right? VC hat. Essentially, it amounts to replacing the forcing relation in the original forcing relation by this new one, and that's all we really need to know for purposes here. Okay. To the new forcing relation. Which is written with the same force, the forcing sign with a C, right? With a C hat as a suffix. And the important thing to note is that for atomic sentences, it's related by this condition here, which is up at the top. Maybe it's a bit difficult to read there. I'll pull it down a bit. And you can see it's quite suggestive that P will now enforce sigma to be true in this new universe, if and only if there's a covering of P, each of whose members forces sigma. That is, PC forces the truth of a sentence just in case, just in case the truth of that sentence is P forced by every event in some C survey of P. The frame induced, and here we have some, and these things have some rather, I think, amusing properties, as we'll see. The frame induced by the dense cover scheme, which we introduced before, turns out to be a complete Boolean algebra. It's really the thing corresponding to introducing double negations. But it turns out to be a complete Boolean algebra. It's classical, so the law of excluded middle holds there. For the corresponding causal set, when we work it out, it satisfies this condition, that Q forces P hat to be a member of K, if and only if Q is in P's causal horizon. The causal horizon, of course, remember, was the double complement of the P downward. Now, if we compare this with the original equivalence, which I called star above, we see that moving to the universe VB, which is really Booleanizing it, because then the internal logic is actually Boolean, it's classical, amounts to replacing causal futures by causal horizons. So that's what you're really doing here. When P is linearly ordered, as for the example in the case of Newtonian time, discrete Newtonian time, the causal horizon of any event coincides with the whole of P. B is the two-element Boolean algebra 2, so it's just classical. And VB reduces to the universe of static sets. In this case, then, the effect of Booleanization is to render the universe timeless. It cuts the evolution out altogether. Right, there's no, it eliminates it, that's the way one would interpret that. The universe is associated with a cover scheme CA, upper A, and lower A. They seem also to have a rather natural physical meaning. Consider, for instance, the case in which A is the sieve, right, P downward. That's right. 14, oh. Let's see, 11, oh, it's here. 50, good. Okay. In which, So I've lost my. Where is it now? Okay. The case in which A is the sieve P hat, right? The causal future of P. All right. So that's the. In the associated universe, associated with the with that covering upper A. The corresponding causal set Ka satisfies, again, for as you when you work it out, that Q forces P hat to be in Ka. Oh, there's a misprint here. Right. For every event Q, it should be Q. If and only, there's a typo there. It should it was somehow got missed out. It's if and only if Q is equal to or less than P. It turns out. So comparing, that we see that in V, every event has been forced. Well, okay, all right, that's a better way of doing it. This is correct, sorry, my mistake. Any event forces, Q always forces P hat is in Ka. In the original star, equation star, it was Q forces P is in K, if and only if Q is in P's causal future. But now we eliminated, every event now is, in a sense, it's been forced into P's causal future because we don't have that. But this is just true absolutely for any Q. So in short, that P now marks the beginning of the universe as viewed from inside V, right, inside this new universe. So effectively, you take P and you do this, you use this particular covering system. And what happens is that in the corresponding universe, P becomes the initial event. Right, it becomes the beginning. So the universe is actually forced to have a beginning there, in a sense. Similarly, we find that in Ka, the other causal set, this causal set associated with the covering C lower A, satisfies the following condition: if Q is equal to or less than P, implies that for all R, right, R is, it forces Q in anything below P is forced by all R to be a member of not Ka. And when you compare that with the original thing we had, reveals that in CA, every event, including P itself, has been placed beyond P's causal horizon, right? Because this thing is beyond the causal horizon, being a member of not K. In effect, then, the event P has been obliterated. It's been effaced from the universe, just like they, if you've ever read H.G. Wells' story, The Man Who Could Work Miracles, the initial event never occurred. It's sort of wiped out. Now, it's a final possibility, and with this I'll close. Not too bad. We consider the universe VP, or actually V, the universe P tilde, associated with what's called the free lower semilattice. We haven't considered that, generated by P. In that case, the elements of P are finite sets of events pre-ordered by the inclusion relation. And the corresponding pre-ordering is that will hold if and only if every event in the set G is in the causal path of an event in F. This is the definition. This gives you what's called the free lower semilattice generated by P. It's a semilattice. It's a lower semilattice. It has meets, not necessarily joins, and it is freely generated by the original P, the original set P. The empty set of events is the top element of P tilde. The causal set K tilde in V P tilde has the property that it is its complement, not K tilde, is empty, it turns out. Okay? So that in this universe, the light cones of any pair of events overlap. Right? It's not static, but it overlaps. And it turns out that the empty, the corresponding tilde of the empty set is an initial event, in the sense that for every event in this universe, F forces the tilde of the empty set to be a member of the corresponding causal set K. So in this case, passage to the new universe preserves the original causal relations in the sense that you can show it doesn't change any of the original causal relations in the universe you started with. The initial event then, this and the new light cone overlaps have been freely adjoined to the original universe. So whereas in the case where you take an event P and force it to be an initial event, you actually change, of course, completely the causal structure, right, of the, as you can easily see, of the original universe. In this case, what we've done is freely adjoin an initial event in such a way that it doesn't disturb any of the original causal relations. So it's freely generated in the usual, right, in the usual mathematical sense. Okay, well, that's all I have. So thank you very much.
Time for questions?
It's also blindingly clear, I know.
I just don't understand one thing. So in your exposition, it looked like the time evolution was going from the fact that it's Hayton valued sets and not Boolean valued sets.
Yeah.
And I don't quite understand that. I mean, I don't understand how in Presheev, so things that you assign to each element in your category, you assign a set such that there will be some relations. And each element in this topos of Presheev, you associate an element in this H value.
Yes, but it's complicated to. I wouldn't actually try to show you how to go from one to the other directly. I know you asked that question before.
Yeah, there's a static in the.
You have to, it's easiest, you can do it from scratch, but I wouldn't do it from scratch. The way I do it.
The recipe is there to build the same type. So for example, the true value.
It's equivalent. It's not, of course, the same. There is a way of going from one to the other, but it's not literally, it's an equivalence of categories.
Yeah.
It's not, if you try to do it from scratch, the way it was done originally by Dennis Higgs, long ago, who used to be at the math department in Waterloo, was you go from, not from VH, but from hiding algebra set H, which is the hiding algebra valued sets, where you have the an equality relation on the set, which is defined with values in the hiding algebra. You turn that into a topos. You can show that H value, I do it in my book. And then you show that because by more general results, that actually that's equivalent to set H. Then you also, and the same general result tells you that that because of the properties of these topuses, they're localic, right? And then their structure is, as categories, as topuses, is completely determined by their truth value algebra. So in all the cases, these cases, the truth value algebra is H, they're all localic, and so they're all equivalent. Now, if you then try directly, it's tricky, It's not obvious how to go directly by tracing you could do it. I haven't done it in my book. It's too messy. But if you want to go say, what is the H-valued set in the universe associated directly with the pre-sheaf? That would take some work. I know, because you asked that question in your...
Well, because it would... continues the same topic more or less that Aisham used, so it'd be interesting to translate everything.
Yeah, well, I haven't done it. I mean, I know that there's certainly, I don't have Higgs's original notes. I mean, I wanted to try to, in my book some years ago, I wanted to avoid having to make those calculations. It was already enough. So I thought, well, let's just use these general results and then, and then appeal to the fact that they're all localic, the topos is in question. They all have the same truth value algebra, so they're all equivalent by general theory. Yeah. However, yes, it's a good question as to how, as to actually tracing it. I mean, it's not with VH, but it was done by Dennis Higgs some years ago between H-valued sets and pre-sheaves. Well, they weren't, it was actually the way that it was done then was, it was the formulation of pre, in terms of Dana Scott's, you know, Scott algebras, you know, he had another formulation too. Mm-hmm. Have you seen those? It's very pretty.
I'm not very familiar.
He axiomatized, you know, pre-sheaf by using, well, H-valued, well, actually, sheaves and pre-sheaves over, right, over partially ordered sets. In a very nice way, turning them into a collection of algebras. And what Higgs showed was that these algebras are equivalent to, right, to H-valued sets. But the trouble is, if you try to do it directly, you know, it's actually quite messy. And I haven't done it directly. So, I mean, you know, life is too short, at least in my case. But yes, it's a good question. I mean, you might like to see, try and do it. You could reconstruct it. If I could find Higgs's paper, but he never published it. It was one of those things that were circulated. And he actually goes through, you know, the whole, at least in the not with VH, but with the H-valued sets anyway. You know, you might like to look at that if I can find it. Or ask the Waterloo Math Department. I mean, he was a professor there for some years, Dennis Higgs. And he did this work, yeah. He did this work in the 70s, and there was a thing circulated. I had a copy of it, but I don't know where it is now. Yeah. But the point really is that one can see, well, for me, I you know, this sort of thing is where I come from. I mean, I work in Boolean valued universes and hiding algebra valued universes, and you sort of see, and you use ordinary set theoretic language there. And it's not so easy sometimes to see when you're working in the purely categorical formulation. Sometimes there's a very simple way of translating the set theoretic language into the category and vice versa, but not always. I mean, let me give you an example. I mean, if you look at synthetic differential geometry, right, where you just do the you do basic calculus in it. But if you try to do it with diagrams, you wouldn't understand anything. You use sort of basic internal language with equations and maybe a little bit of, you know, sort of basic set theory, and it's very clear. It is, of course, always reflected in the, right, in the underlying category, and it'll be some diagrams. But if you look at, just take an example. Mordack and Race wrote a completely honest book with the constructions. It's called Models for Synthetic Differential, for Smooth Infinitesimal Analysis. And, you know, they actually go through the whole construction, and it's 200 pages. You want to spell it all out. What you've got at the end is something you can just work with as if it was ordinary mathematics. But it's a bit like building, you know, some piece of machinery that may be very delicate. You know, and of course, each piece will actually have the property that it's designed to do. But actually translating it's something like translating from machine code into something we can understand, and I think it's in the case of going from H-valued sets to pre, you know, is all that difficult. It's just that it's an instance of the same kind of problem, yeah. A simpler instance, but yeah. I should just say, I don't propose obliterating them and so on. I mean, it's science fiction. I mean, it's very pretty science fiction, I think. But I think there should be much more use of, sheaf theory and use of Grothendieck topologies and so forth here. I don't think it's really been exploited yet. Right, we were talking about that. It's very important. It's become extremely important in mathematics. As I say, use of Grothendieck. That you can produce these extraordinary mathematical frameworks in which every function is smooth. You have nilpotent infinitesimals. It's all rigorous. And that's done by using these constructions, which are actually quite different. They're delicate constructions, but when you finally have them, you have something that you can just step on the gas with. And in physics, I think there's been some argument. One interesting development, not sort of connected with this, is in synthetic, in a smooth topos, which is really a generalization. I'll give you another talk on that sometime, maybe, on space-time, in the smooth topos, right, or in smooth infinitesimal analysis. And there, the idea was to do differential geometry, which was Lovier's idea in the 60s. Actually, he wanted to axiomatize continuum mechanics properly, following Truesdell. And so he got interested in category theory early, of course, revolutionized it. But the idea was to have a category, to have a really nice category of manifolds. Right? I mean, if you actually look at any kind of differential geometry, there's all this problem, all this song and dance about defining tangent vectors. And of course, because classically, you can't have an infinitesimal tangent vector. It's inconsistent. Although all the early differential geometers, and Lee and Cantin and all the rest of them, used that idea. They knew it wasn't very rigorous, but it was very intuitive. Weyl too. Anyway, the idea was to have there's two problems with that, with the usual category of manifolds when you carve it out of the category of sets. It's not Cartesian closed, right? It has products, but it doesn't have exponentials, right? You can't take the smooth functions of one manifold, it's not closed under exponentials. So the idea was, and so in order to be able to do differential geometry, you embed, so to speak, this is all anachronistic, but essentially the kind of manifolds, which were there before sets, right? I mean, Riemann introduced them, and set theory was nowhere then. He introduced them in 1854. And then the idea was, then we can give a definition of a manifold later on in terms of set theory, which was done, and it was made rigorous. Although, actually, the founders of differential geometry didn't use it. They argued in a sort of intuitive way. And then, so the idea was that the tangent space, right, or the tangent bundle of the manifold is really, intuitively constructed as small pi, small motions in the manifold. Little movement, but of course the manifold's curved. You can't have something straight, at least classically. It would have to be an infinitesimal, which it was traditionally, right? all those dx's and so forth. And so what they did instead was to say, the tangent bundle is then constructed set theoretically, because the category of sets is closed under exponentials. You can talk about spaces of maps and so forth. But then, in that case, you have to introduce all kinds of things that aren't very natural in differential geometry. For example, functions which aren't smooth, or functions which are discontinuous. And in particular, you don't actually have this infinitesimal tangent vector, which is part of the intuitions of the early differential geometers. And then Lovier realized that if you could construct the tangent bundle directly by saying that it's the exponential. You take a manifold, and you take the infinitesimal object, and then it's just the exponent of that, because it's a set of all maps of the infinitesimal object into the manifold. And then what essentially that does, if you were able to embed the category of manifolds into a Cartesian closed category, not the category of sets, because that doesn't have infinitesimal objects and it's got discontinuous maps, right, in which no new maps are introduced, so they're still all smooth if you're working in the traditional, right, it's the infinity setup. Then you have a framework in which you can do differential geometries completely synthetically, as the original people did. I mean, they didn't have a rigorous account of it. But in order to be able to do that, there's a large amount of engineering, right, that has to be done to actually get a category that satisfies those basic axioms that every function is locally straight, and curves are locally straight, or functions are locally always infinitesimally affine, and so on, and that takes a lot of work. But once you have it, you then can do differential geometry. And now, apparently, the next move, and it's being being done by Gonzalo Reyes, who was always interested in this, is to do general relativity there. It's a natural framework for it. I mean, it's true that the difficulty, of course, is that the language, see, the language is sort of clear. People get turned off by the fact you've got to get the, you know, you have to do a lot of category work to get the models, that's all. But you don't even need to worry about that. Actually, they've been done. I mean, I know you're worried because you want to see the nuts and bolts of it. But the point is that as far as applying some, not this stuff, but I mean, you know, synthetic differential geometry or smooth infinitesimal analysis in physics, well, you'd already do that. I wrote a little book on doing all the basic mechanics and calculus, right? Simple, really nice. Ignore squares of small quantities, just like engineers. It's rigorous, very pretty.
I suggest you to thank John.
Sorry? Thank you very much. All right, okay.